Hi, I'm it's great to be here. I'm going to start with a poem that's a request from the one of the last times I read in online for Pittsburgh. I hope maybe in the next year or so I'll be able to actually read in Pittsburgh. But until then, this is pretty good. This first one is called American Sadness. Of all the sadness in the world, there's nothing that can compare with American sadness. When America is sad, the whole world weeps. Whenever one American is sad, at least two non-Americans somewhere else in the world consider the possibility of ending it all. When 100 Americans are sad, wars are fought in faraway lands for the great purpose of making these 100 Americans happy again. When a million Americans are sad, every flag in America droops and slides an inch and then another inch down the flagpole, and nothing can stop this descent until bold, confident smiles return to these Americans' faces. American sadness, let's make it clear, is exceptional. Unlike what you may have heard, it doesn't always talk softly, but it always carries a big stick, because no one is sad the way an American is sad. No one drags his feet through the dullness of a day or walks with her eyes looking downward quite as sadly as an American who feels sad because America is losing a battle, coming in second, or washing ashore with empty pockets and bad breath. America, of course, American sadness, of course, is the greatest sadness in the world. Do not look it in the eye unless your intention is to make amends. Do not settle for a knowing grin or a sliding into place of the proper order of thought or things. Work hard, do your best, and fight whenever a fist is called for or a bomb needs to be dropped upon a civilian population whose greatest misfortune is not being American. But above all, keep American sadness at bay, like a ship that wrecks offshore through instability or for fault of navigation. Let's remember to keep America happy. Let's keep America entertained. And this next one, it's a little lighter, but it still hits some of the same kind of targets. This is called Robert Frost. And this is actually, I always say this, it's actually pretty much true. In the 90s, I decided I needed to spend more time thinking about my career as a poet. So when my friend Sharon told me there was a poet's party at Stephen's apartment, I decided I should attend. There was a bar nearby, so I went there first. The bartender there was a friend of mine. I had a lot of friends who were bartenders, not as many as the poet friends I had, but if I'd ever decided to change careers, there were people in the business I could talk to. I talked to a woman who had the eyes of a psychic and was disgusted about something. I was fascinated, but being a poet, I had to leave to be with the poets at the poet's party. When I knocked and Stephen himself answered the door, I saw a room full of poets holding drinks, smoking cigarettes, talking about poems and books and concepts and all the beautiful things in the world. And I loved them all and everything they thought about so much. And I was out of my mind by then, not with grief or disgust, but with beauty. And there was nothing else for me to do except say, "You're an asshole," to Tom, to Amy, to Ed, to Robert, to Paul, to Ken, to John, to Charles, to Kim, to Mike, to Stephanie. And in case I missed anyone, declare, "Everyone in this room is an asshole." The next day I ran into Tom on the street and Tom asked me, "So am I still an asshole?" And Tom's hair was swaying with the wind, even though there was no wind, and the salt and pepper in his mustache fell lightly to the sidewalk as children walked by, because it was Sunday and they were doing Sunday things. And this was New York, so everyone was always moving, always sad, always happy, always eating things they shouldn't be eating. And I answered, "Yes, Tom, you were still an asshole. And the East River is a dirty, muddy mess, except for that hour when it catches the sunlight just so and reminds me that beauty, even as it edges away, from my still primitive soul, and despite what anyone else has ever said, is never a diminished thing. Let me hold. And this one is called Stone Soul Picnic after the Laura Nero song. The Stone Soul Picnic was where I first held your hand 30 years before we were born, as we watched a red wine and golden apple colored sunset that made us shiver slightly like swimmers rising from warm water into cool air. I was a sailor of ships, a flyer of kites, a child of old city streets on vacation during the summer of broken windows. I wrote stories that began with the word how and ended with the word because I didn't know how to say it any other way. And the years were like dry ice, melting, then turning into mist, into pink fog over the winding waters we followed as we brought our covers, our fires, and our black iron pots with cracked edges all covered with grease and fat. And the mist rose higher and higher, then rained back down on us with the fury of fists, and food grew scarce, and we grew tired and slow, and our thoughts turned to black and white like old TVs and old fading photographs. And I went to the woman with a loudly beating heart, breathing heavily like her, and asked, "Can you show me the way to Bending Creek the next time it rains frogs in the afternoon? We'll be very hungry by then, and their deep fried legs will make good eating on the red blanket on the green grass with the music playing like open-eyed love through a storm. Why, if we had their power to jump, we could see hazy or even clear over the mountains and in the midst of these strange, unforeseen events, when land starts to shake and skies tremble and fall, we'll know what to do and how. We'll save ourselves, our tribe, our land, which follows us whichever way we go. Why, we might even save the world, but don't count on it, motherfucker." And a couple more. This is a long one and then a short one. This is called Interview with the Mountain. When I first came to interview the mountain, it said the hour was late, that it was too tired, that it doubted it had anything of significance to say, anything worthy of putting in print. The second time it said it didn't trust me, that I was a foreigner who would never understand its ways, who had his own agenda that would make the rivers, the ocean, even the deer and wildcats seem more important than they really were, and less vindictive and more fun. The third time we sat and stared at each other. I had brought along my lunch and I bit into my sandwich and sipped my iced tea as the mountains looked at me in silence, refusing to eat. The fourth time I brought a friend who drank whiskey and played songs on his violin, who asked the mountain what he thought about the moon, and the mountain just said that it didn't think about the moon and that it thought about the moon as often as it thought about us. The fifth time I brought a book, which I read silently to myself while the mountain slept until well past noon, when it said that it didn't believe the seasons were real. The changes in temperature, the drifting snow, and the turning of the leaves were created by men and women living in cities who had never even seen a mountain. The sixth time I took my wife and my daughter ran around chasing butterflies, while my wife and I breathed in deeply, looking at the blue of the sky, imagining the shapes of the animals. Not once did we try to speak to the mountain, and not once did we look at it. The seventh time I climbed slowly to the top and back down again with my eyes closed, waiting for the mountain to speak, finally to say something about its past, how it's not as tall as it once was, how none of us are growing, how nothing in the world grows for very long, and how the rivers betrayed him and the oceans shifted their weight. I went to sleep without thinking of rescuing him and without showing him how to swim or build a boat, and how the animals never taught him how to find cover or how to protect himself, and why it serves no purpose for man or moon a bird or flower for a mountain to speak when everything around him is falling. Then in the early morning, as the shadows took quick steps toward the city, I left and came back with a knife and fork, and I ate the mountain, breaking him apart into sand and rocks, gnawing on the pieces with my monstrous teeth, eating until I was full, until the mountain was all gone, because I live in the country now and no longer have the voices of the city or the cries of sirens echoing down dark streets or words of lesser wisdom to hold me back. And I love the slower pace of life here and the way flowers in their season take all the time they need to blossom. Thanks. And this is one last short one, which I read in the last reading, but I lost the last two lines of it, so I couldn't finish it. So for this reading, I get to read the whole poem. This is called For Lovers and Other Refugees of the Fascist State. This is from a series of sonnets that I've been writing since around the pandemic began. Love is like an element in its place on the periodic table, its properties made clear through comparisons to all the other elements. How easily love turns to liquid, the energy assumed in maintaining a gaseous state, the cold it takes to create a dense and fearsome mass. When solid, love is where we live, for there's nothing we can carry from it in this form. When it's liquid, we travel to and from love the way one rambles west in one's youth to find fame, then east to find fortune. Now we live in the age of vapors, gasping for breath, running for the exits. In the middle of dim, rough days and cruel centuries, let our love be electric and our home a movable foundation. Thank you.